The views and comments expressed on The Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on The Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
To go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Start. Five, three, two, one.
It's The Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of The Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to our Tuesday evening Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. It's great to be here. Gorgeous night in the San Francisco Bay Area. I hope wherever you are, it is equally as nice. Let's run through the announcements. You can call and talk to our guest of honor tonight, who I will introduce in a minute. The toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Do remember that there are no call screeners here, so let the phone ring. We'll answer it as quickly as possible. We'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. We do hold you over breaks on this show, and we also will answer the call if you call and we're still on a break. So again, 1-866-687-7223. You can also use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Do remember we're trademarked and copyrighted, but you do have permission to download our programs and share them. They are compressed MP3 formats. A 90-minute program is about 40 megabytes. So figure out how you want to pass that around to your friends. If you need ideas on how to do that because it's too big for email, please send me a note at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Don't edit the shows, please. Nothing commercial, no private YouTube channels or anything like that. And also, we don't permit written transcripts, even if they're for your own use. So we thank you for honoring our request. We do podcasts. We thank Andrew at Gigadial.net for that service. We're in iTunes and we're in Microsoft Zoom and a host of other places. You'll find our RSS feed URL on our website and both of our newsletters if you'd like to subscribe to our podcast. And then, of course, if you have any questions, do let me hear from you. Visit our newsletter on our website. You can't possibly miss it. And it's uploaded fresh Sunday evening and it has all of the week's programs on it, the full bios and the full description of the programs. Plus, it's the only place you'll find a coming events section for what's up on the near future for the Space Show. If we have to change schedules, which we do sometimes, you'll find it here first. So to stay current, I suggest you check it every once in a while. You can also subscribe to the very short email newsletter. It goes out early Monday morning, California time. Send your request to drspace@thespaceshow.com. There is a store on our website. You'll see it up near the top. It says Space Show Gear. And then probably the most important button is the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with the One Giant Leap Foundation. And we thank all of you who do support us and who will be supporting us. If you have any questions about supporting the Space Show, please send me a note at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then remember also we are partially brought to you by the Secure World Foundation. They promote cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, please do visit their website, secureworldfoundation.org. It is a real honor to bring back to the Space Show Rusty Schweikert, and he is with us. We're going to be talking planetary defense this evening. Rusty, of course, is still involved as a supporter and working out with the B612 Foundation, which is about planetary defense. He is known as an astronaut that joined NASA early on. I think he was in the third group of astronauts selected. He was a lunar module pilot for Apollo 9 from March 3rd through the 13th in 1969. Logging 241 hours in space. Do you know, Rusty, probably most people listening to this show were not even born in 1969? I mean, that's amazing.
You have one of those very young audiences, David.
Well, yes, it is. The a lot of people in the space community are pretty young.
Yeah. Thank heaven.
And listeners, his bio is up on the website many times over, as he has been doing lots of space shows on the important question of planetary defense. So rather than to continue reading about him, let's talk to him, because there is a situation out there known as 2011 AG5, which we will talk about. It seems to be sort of a prime impact event that might take place. Rusty, welcome back to the space show. And are we about to get hit?
Well, probably a few hundred thousand to a million times tonight. But luckily, such small things that they burn up in the atmosphere. We call them shooting stars. But you know, once in a while they get bigger. And as you know, David, quite near here, out in the gold country in California, we had one hit just the other night. It didn't hit at high speed, broke up in the atmosphere, and pieces made it to the ground, but people actually saw it early in the morning, in daylight. So it was a fairly large size. I mean, you know, about the size of a SUV or something like that.
Right. They said in the news articles that it broke up and would have had the force of about 2 kilotons or something like that. So.
Yeah, and you know, things that are even as much as 10 times that diameter, you know, 2 to 3 meters, also don't make it through the atmosphere. But when they get that big, and those then, you know, hit maybe once every 200 years instead of once every year, then they start having effects on the ground. You don't just find bits and pieces of them laying in the parking lots. The way we did with this one, the so-called Sutter's Mill meteorite right now. But you end up with a forest flattened, and if there's a city underneath, maybe a city flattened. So, you know, you got these things do happen, and they're going to continue to happen until we get our act together.
So what is involved in getting our act together? Obviously, we can't stop them from coming in, so the idea is to somehow mitigate against them, right?
Yes. Well, the idea is that we can stop them before they come in. That is the general scheme, although, you know, we might want to talk about that. There is obviously a break point where it is at relatively small scale. It's easier to evacuate an impact point than it is, or it's less costly, well, let me put it that way, to evacuate an impact point rather than to send up a mission and deflect something at, you know, something like $1 billion. So there is a trade-off there that has to be made, which reminds me, one, not a correction, but let me just say a minor addition to the things that I have been doing and am still supporting, and that is, B612 Foundation deals with the physical stuff of deflection, but the organization that deals with the geopolitical elements of it, which are quite interesting and rather sticky, is the Association of Space Explorers, and in particular the NEO Committee, which I chaired up until last year, and now astronaut Tom Jones is chairing it, and I'm backing him up.
Okay. So there's a lot of issues to cover here. I mean, do we have enough warning time now in 2012 where we could evacuate an area or attempt to deflect it, whichever the case may be? Are we that far along now in our detection and our pinpointing what's about to happen?
Well, David, I assume you're talking specifically there about 2011 AG5.
Well, we can use that one as the model for our discussion.
Yeah. Well, it's a, you know, you have to there is a general discussion worth having, and then there are specifics, and the only specific really worth talking about is 2011 AG5. It's the highest impact probability Well, it's at the top, let me put it that way. It's at the very top of the risk table for asteroid impacts that is published by JPL, and also there's a parallel one sort of that the Italians do. But it's at the top of the list in terms of the general threat level. It would have an impact. If it did impact, it would impact in 2040, in February of 2040. To do that, it would first have to come close to the Earth, pass close by the Earth in 2023, and go through a very narrow region in space there where the Earth would reshape its trajectory in such a way that it would come back in 2040. We call that small region a keyhole, so it would have to go through a keyhole in 2023 that's several lunar distances out. But if it did that, it would end up hitting the Earth. So we can prevent that one from hitting the Earth by keeping it from going through that 2023 keyhole if, in fact, it is headed for it.
So do we know yet if it's headed for that keyhole?
Well, we do. Let me put it this way. We know imprecisely that it's headed in the general direction of the keyhole, and it has about a 1 in 500 probability of actually going through the keyhole at this point. As you know, David, we never in science or anywhere else for that matter, except maybe fiction or something, we never make perfect measurements. There's no such thing as a perfect measurement. There are always small uncertainties. And those small uncertainties, when you project an asteroid's orbit out 20 or 30 years or something like that, end up giving you a fairly large uncertainty. We therefore have to keep tracking these things, and as you get closer and closer to an event, the probability or the uncertainty, let me say, level gets smaller and smaller. But at the moment, the best that we can say is that the probability of that impact occur, well, the keyhole passage, and therefore the impact being set up is 1 in 500.
So what do we do now? We just watch it and measure it and keep track of it? Is that the best we do right now?
Well, in the general case, that the answer to that would be a very clear yes. In this particular case, the reason this one has been talked about to some extent is that I took a look at this last year. From about mid-year on, I started watching it fairly closely, and the impact probability kept going up. And that led me to ask the question, well, given that that keyhole, 2023, is only something like 11 years away, that would mean that we'd probably have to launch something in about 9 years. And I'm looking at that and saying, well, would we really be ready to launch actually a dual mission? We can talk about that later, but you want an observer up there and you want to send up a kinetic impactor, something that runs into it to change its orbit, but you have to observe that process. So you're talking about a dual mission kind of thing. And to do that and get that all done within a matter of 11 years, you know, starts to get non-trivial. And so I asked the question and started doing some analysis, which sort of indicated it was marginal, that we were rapidly approaching the time where we would have to make some kind of a commitment, and there might be some long lead time stuff that we should be doing even now. And so that's the issue which I throughout to NASA and JPL, and then in February of this year to the United Nations.
And the response you got back?
Well, it was very interesting. The response that I got back from the European NEO people, asteroid people, to whom I also sent my analysis, was pretty interesting. Now, they actually have a program called NeoShield, which had started, about 18 months ago or a year ago, something like that. They're really just getting underway. But that program, that NeoShield program in Europe, is specifically designed to look at deflection and deflection technology, deflection capability, issues, etc. So that's the first time where space agencies, companies, and others have been funded by governments to look seriously at deflection. The result of that is that they were kind of ready to take a quick shot at this analysis, that preliminary analysis I had done, and they came up with some very interesting things. My analysis, it turned out, was slightly pessimistic compared with theirs, but their analysis also indicated that this was a pretty close situation, that we could certainly deflect it, but the question of when we would have to start doing preliminary planning and even some software development, that kind of thing, is still somewhat of an open question. The answer I got from NASA was pretty much a quick response without any real analysis behind it, but basically saying, well, this situation, if you look at the timing, is essentially analogous to the Deep Impact mission, where we ran the Deep Impact spacecraft into Comet Tempel 1 back in 2005. And, you know, we were able to do that, and so we ought to be able to do this. And I didn't find that a very satisfying answer from NASA. I expected something a little bit more analytical, and as a minimum, having, you know, looking at the analysis I did and pointing out any shortcomings or whatever. I wrote back to the NASA administrator and said, you know, there's real analysis here that needs to be done by NASA. It's, you know, we can't just rely on an analogy from 2005, which really doesn't quite match up. And I stated my reasons for believing that. And so we're now in a situation where JPL is doing analysis and has done some analysis. It's preliminary at the moment. But they are now looking at it, and the results are, let me just say, optimistic that we can do it. The issue of whether there is some early lead time work that needs to be done is still somewhat open.
If we were to launch a mission in 9 years, how far out would this NEO be at the time of our interception?
Well, you know, David, that sounds like a really good question, and it would be if these things sort of came straight in from out there, way out there. But, you know, these are all solar system objects, and we circulate around the sun together like neighbors driving around the neighborhood on a day-to-day basis. And the issue is not, how far out it would be or that kind of thing. Over the years, it gets close to us, it gets very far away from us. I mean, sometimes it's on the opposite side of the sun, sometimes it's within, a couple of lunar distances of us as it makes a pass. So these things circulate around, the issue is not really how close to us. What we would have to do would be to launch an observer spacecraft. If we wanted to ensure that we kept it out of the keyhole, we would first want to launch an observer spacecraft that would get out there, rendezvous with it, and be in position sometime around, 2019 or 2020, something like that. And then we would probably have to, if in fact the observer spacecraft determined that it is headed for an impact or for, you know, keyhole passage, we would then launch a kinetic impact spacecraft, which would come up and run into it, and the observer spacecraft would verify that. and then come in close afterward to precisely measure the new orbit to make sure and confirm that, in fact, it was now going to miss the Earth in 2040. So that's the process, and if you think about, you know, launching in something like 2018 or something, an Observer spacecraft, then, you know, waiting until the next time we see with our telescopes AG5, which is one of the things that NASA feels strongly that we can do, the question is, can we really wait until we see it the next time? For which there's very good reason. I'll get to that in a second. But if we wait until then, before we start doing any work, can we really get the job done? That's really the issue.
Do we have today the technology, you know, the capability of doing this? Do we have a kinetic impact? Can we make that and do it? I know we've come and hit asteroids and we sent a probe and hit the moon and other things. So is this kind of off-the-shelf technology for us?
Well, yes and no. Conceptually, it's certainly off the shelf. I mean, there's nothing terribly sophisticated about running into something. I mean, you know, it's not at all exotic. And yet, at the same time, it is physically challenging because you're flying out there into a solar orbit and putting yourself on an intercept trajectory. But these are very small objects. You're not talking about flying to the moon or something. You're talking about flying to something that's a few times bigger than your house. You know, that's a pretty small object in space. So there are some navigation issues, but the real issue is the terminal guidance. I mean, you're closing on this thing at, gosh, I should have worked that number out, but let me just say you're closing on it at, you know, several thousand miles an hour. It's a pretty small dot, and all of a sudden, you know, you're past it. So in very few seconds, you've got to get some tracking information on it and make some terminal guidance corrections and inputs which allow you to literally and confidently run into an object which is 100 meters, 140 meters in this case, across. So while 140 meters is pretty big compared with you and I, and most people's houses, by the way, it's a pretty small object in space when you're going at it several thousand miles an hour.
You know, really interesting. Here's your first question is from Larry in Los Angeles, and Larry says, have all of the impacts that we know of that hit Earth, like Meteor Crater, the dinosaurs, Tunguska, have they gone through a keyhole?
We don't really know that. You know, I would give you a slightly different answer than the guys at JPL. We don't know that they went through a keyhole because we don't really know what trajectory they were on. We're looking at a hole in the ground, or in the case of Chicxulub, the more indirect evidence. There is a hole in the ground, but it's not as obvious as Meteor Crater. That's all we have. We can imply slightly the angle at which it impacted, but to go from there to a trajectory and the specific dates and all of that are, you know, is impossible. So there's no way to know. Now, I said I would give a different answer from JPL. I would totally agree with what they would have said, and I'm sure they would have said what I just did. However, look at it this way. If you and the JPL guys and I have had a discussion over the years, but almost every object that ever hits the Earth or any other planet, but let's just take the Earth at the moment. Any object that hits the Earth has been flying around the sun in all likelihood for millions, if not a billion years. But certainly for many, many, many years, it's been flying around the sun in its own orbit, paying, you know, never no mind. It's just flying around F equals MA. And then one day, whack, there is the Earth, right?
Right.
Now, if you go backward, generally speaking, if you go back from an impact year after year after year in advance, you will find that that same object came close to the Earth at an earlier date. And any time an object, an asteroid or a comet or anything else, a spacecraft for that matter, comes flying close by the Earth changes its trajectory. And if it then subsequently hits the Earth, it went through a keyhole at that prior close encounter. So almost every object was deflected by, generally speaking, almost every Earth-impacting object was generally deflected at some earlier time by the Earth itself on a close approach or by some other planet. But it's more the Earth than other planets because of the plane changes and things of that kind. So in general, you can say that every object that hits the Earth had a close call with the Earth in all likelihood or some other planet, which set up that impact. And that's exactly what a keyhole is.
Here's another one for you, which is Paul in Tucson. Let's say you deflect something. Is there a law of unintended consequences here? Do we have any idea if deflecting it might make something worse down the road?
Sure, but if I sneeze, probably 100 years from now, somebody dies. I mean, the answer is yes. If I have the chance to avoid, 1,000 or 1,000,000 or 100,000,000 deaths, 10 years from now, with some unknown consequence in another 1,000 years, I'll do that. That's a kind of a general thing. You know, let's deal with the things that we know are going to happen. We make every effort that we don't have some consequence that we can foresee as a result of that, but there is no guarantee of that. Now, there are some, long-range schemes where you might deflect an asteroid, or let me put it this way, once you touch one, you own it, that kind of game, where you say, okay, well, if I deflect this one now, yes, indeed, I now have caused it to enter a different trajectory than nature did, and therefore I have some responsibility for it for the future. So maybe what we do, if we ever get launch costs down low enough, is you say, okay, well, let's just get rid of these things. Let's clear Earth's space of these asteroids. Let's not just make them not hit 20 years from now or 22 years from now on February 5th, but let's say, okay, let's pop the thing so that we can use gravity assist and over many, many years get it out close enough to Jupiter that Big Jupe takes care of it, kicks it out of the solar system, or at least changes its perihelion so that it doesn't come by the Earth anymore. So there is a kind of long-term cleaning out the Earth's orbit of these dangerous objects, but that's way, way beyond anything anybody is thinking right now. I mean, we're just thinking of the immediate prevent the next impact.
If we focus again on 2011 AG5,
yeah,
and we decide to do something about it, who pays for the mission? Is it a United States sole effort? Is it our hardware? I mean, how does this work on the international level?
Well, David, I want to come back to something in a moment, so let's both of us remember to do that. I want to talk about the next observations of AG5 and the consequence of those things. But to get to that question you just asked, that question is what we deal with in the United Nations on this subject. The Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, or affectionately known as the Outer Space Committee of the United Nations, or COPUS, has the whole subject of near-Earth objects and preventing impacts is a major topic in their agenda, and they have been working it since 2005 and before. We ended up jumping in about 2005 and really got it moving, but that subject is a discussion which goes on in the United Nations. Obviously, there are more nations than the United States. There are spacefaring nations, and those who populate that cohort will change from time to time. But, you know, right now there's obviously the United States, Russia, China, Japan, India, and I'm leaving somebody out, ESA, the European Space Agency, who have the capability, at least the hypothetical capability, of launching things into deep space and, you know, causing an asteroid deflection. Now, the United States and Europe have been the most active in the area and certainly understand the issue best. Russia has been making some noises, but has not really joined conversationally in the issues very much. And the other nations have done even less. But that decision would have to be made among the spacefaring nations. Who's going to take care of this? Who's going to do something? Do we all agree what needs to be done? Do we all agree that anything needs to be done? I mean, those are the kinds of discussions which we have been triggering and hosting, actually, in the form of what we call an MPOG, a Mission Planning and Operations Group. That's basically the group of nations who can do something about it. Okay? Uh-huh. There's another group that we have, which is the Information Analysis and Warning Network, which is the smart guys like Don Yeomans and the troops at JPL and the people in PISA, some of the people in Europe, in the European Space Situational Awareness people group. These are the analysts who look at, track, discover, and predict impacts. And those groups all should be international and should be communicating on a continuing basis about this situation. But when we find something that is serious and we've got to act, then it gets a good bit more complicated, because the question that you just asked, who pays for it? You know, if the United States is going to deflect it, is it going to be the U.S. taxpayers who pay for it? Especially if, let's say, the risk corridor where it might hit doesn't include the United States. You know, yes, you should take care of your fellow human beings here. I mean, you know, we have an obligation in that sense. But, you know, there should be cost sharing, and that's one of the many, many issues which the Association of Space Explorers identified as critical issues which need to be decided by the Outer Space Committee. So those discussions are ongoing. It's very interesting stuff.
So here's another question from Becky in Chicago. And Becky says, if it goes through the keyhole, is it too late to deflect it?
Very good question, Becky. Somebody's been doing their homework. That question depends upon a particular situation, and sometimes the answer is no, and other times the answer is yes. And as luck would have it, the answer with 2011 AG-5 is probably, or maybe. I mean, it would be a challenge, but it goes, you know, the keyhole here is 2023, and the impact would be 2040. So you're talking 17 years. But the question is, when, how soon after it went through the keyhole would you have confirmation? Would you know adequately, you know, what track it's on? And now, because it's got to miss the Earth, this is a much, much more significant deflection. The keyhole is only 300 kilometers in this case, 300 kilometers wide. They vary from less than a kilometer up to something like this, 300 or 400 kilometers. So that's a substantial deflection when you're talking about, you know, moving something with the mass of an asteroid. But when you talk about making it miss not 300 kilometers, but 20,000 kilometers, the effective diameter of the Earth, you know, with gravitational focusing and things, you're talking a different magnitude. So you've got to hit it earlier to deflect it adequately. The mission has probably got to use the biggest boosters we've got, et cetera. So the answer is probably we could do it. But again, both deflecting this from the keyhole, because that's fairly close in time, and deflecting it after the keyhole, because then it's a very serious deflection that's got to occur, are both sitting on the edge. And that's why I called for this. It's why I did the analysis I did last year, and why I submitted it to NASA and to the European agencies to take a look at and, you know, do a professional analytic job on.
So if you're saying we have to use the biggest boosters we have, is this a case then for having heavy lift? I don't hear that as a reason why we need heavy lift, but have you just made a case for having heavy lift boosters?
Well, you know, again, if we go to the general case, the answer is if we had a heavy lift booster, there are cases where we could deflect an asteroid with a single mission, as opposed to maybe having to launch three or four kinetic impacts at some fairly sizable object. But, you know, it's not a terribly good rationale for a heavy lift booster, in the sense that these things, especially of a size that would require a heavy lift booster to deflect them, occur so infrequently. But, you know, when it takes a big gun, you better have a big gun, or your survival can be in danger. So you know, it's always nice to have a little in the back pocket, you know, that you don't need.
So if you can't deflect, then you talked about earlier in the show possibly evacuate.
Yeah.
So let's just stay with 2011 AG5. It doesn't.
Well, David,
get
let me make one comment here.
Okay.
Let me pick up on deflection.
Okay.
First of all, I think you know, we need to really make sure that people who are listening to the show understand that the probability of this thing hitting is very low. I mean, 1 in 500. While it is high for an asteroid impact probability, 1 in 500 is still very low. Now, it's certainly not zero. It's significantly higher than that. And we will get additional tracking on this object before we have to actually spend a lot of money on anything. I think we may need to spend a little money for some very early analytic and perhaps some testing work. But the big money can probably wait until after the next time we see it, which is in September of 2013. And the likelihood is that when we see it again in 2013, we can't see it now because it's on the other side of the sun, but it does get close enough to us with a good enough angle in 2013. So when we see it in 2013, it's about a 90% probability that the impact is going to drop to zero. I mean, the probability of an impact is going to drop to zero. And then we can see it again in 2015. So we have several more opportunities to see it. And, you know, the likelihood is that it's not going to hit us, and we'll know that before we have to spend much money. The whole reason why I have raised this as an issue, and why I, you know, pushed it in the United Nations and pushed it with the NASA administrator, is because of that 1 in 500 chance. If it is going to, if it is headed for the keyhole, you want to definitely make sure you can prevent the impact. So, you know, you can't count on the 499. You know, if you want to not have a big hole in the ground and maybe several hundreds of thousands of people dead or something, you want to work on the worst case. You want to make the assumption that it is headed for it and make sure that you're ready for it.
So the chances of this hitting are significantly greater than those three people who won the nearly $1 billion lottery. but they won the lottery.
Well, let me give you a very, very pragmatic example of what 1 in 500 probability means. The chance, David, that you or I or anybody listening who happens to be a typical American driver of having a car accident in the next 3 weeks is almost exactly 1 in 500. So I hope I don't have an accident, and I probably won't have one in the next 5 weeks, but I've had accidents in my life, so, you know, it's not...
So have I.
Yeah, it's real, but it's not, you know, it's not something to get panicked over or anything else, but you want to do your homework, and that's what we're trying to make sure happens.
So speaking here from the point of view of someone who has had statistics hit them in the face with things that are not supposed to happen very often, I can say this stuff really does happen. And if you're the one it happens to, it doesn't matter if it's 1 in 500 or 1 in 10,000.
Yeah, you bet.
I mean, you're getting hit with the illness or this or that. You know, in 2013, can we see it with the naked eye
or with binoculars?
Nothing like that.
This is such a small object. You know, that's not a possibility. It's still pretty far away from us. We need pretty big telescopes to see it. In fact, there's a very, very slim chance, and this is something which we are working internationally right now. There is a very slim chance that we may be able to see it with, you know, big telescopes like Keck or some of the big telescopes in South America and Chile.
Uh-huh.
Late this year, it's kind of a marginal case. It's only about 40 degrees from the sun, and telescopes don't like to point that close to the sun, and it's pretty far away. But if we can get one of the big telescopes with some discretionary time or something to take a look at it, we may be able to get some early indication of whether, in fact, it's headed for the keyhole. Or let me say, it will either drop the probability close to zero, or it may say, well, we should get, you know, we should do our homework. You know, maybe a reminder. So we're trying to see if we can get a piece of big glass to look at it late this year. But barring that, we're going to see it with the normal NEO tracking telescopes in 2013, in September of 2013.
You have a caller on hold. Hopefully they're still holding. Hi, caller. Are you with us, please?
I am.
And you are, please?
My name is Carl from New Hampshire.
Ah, welcome to the show, Carl.
Well, hi there. Glad to be on.
Go ahead with Rusty.
Hey, I was wondering, what are some things that could be done at comparatively low cost that would benefit the B612 Foundation? What are things that could be funded with a Kickstarter or a wealthy benefactor, something that could be done for a few thousand dollars to a few tens of thousands of dollars that would benefit planetary defense?
Well, you know, Carl, thanks for the question. It's a very good question, and you put a constraint on it, which is tough, low cost. Let me just say B612 today is, you know, we've done a lot of work in terms of deflection technology, but the highest priority today is finding the asteroids which are still dangerous, but we haven't found yet. And those tend to be the smaller objects, more difficult to find, like this one we're talking about, 2011 AG5, 140 meters in diameter. We've only, you know, when you talk about the big ones, we know about we've got about 95% of them now that we've found over 1 kilometer. But when you get down to the ones in this range of 140 meters, we've only found about 10% of the ones that we believe are out there. So 90% are yet undiscovered. And when you get down to smaller ones yet, like Tunguska, which would have wiped out any city if it had hit over it, you know, that's about a 40-meter object. There we found less than 1% of them, so we got 99% to go. So the most important thing right now is getting up a telescope, probably a space telescope, which is what B612 is advocating right now and working on. And that's big. That's pretty big money for a nonprofit. That's, you know, for NASA, it's peanuts. But you know, for something like 501c3 nonprofit, that's you know, $700 million for the whole program over 10 years. That's pretty big money. So if you're talking about helping out with several thousand dollars, then what we need, I mean, we can use $1 million, and to some people that's relatively small, and that would really help help us get the initial work done. But if you're talking several thousand dollars, the biggest thing in my mind, and I'm really speaking for myself here, not B612 or anything else, but the biggest thing that could be done in my mind would be to convince your congressmen, senators, political people, representatives, that it was time that Washington, both the Congress and the White House, assign NASA a definite responsibility that they're the ones that have to protect us from asteroid impacts. Ironically, that has not been done. NASA does have the obligation to find them. And NASA sort of has the obligation to develop the technology which would enable us to deflect them. But NASA does not yet have a clear responsibility to protect the Earth from a known threat. And that is a serious shortcoming, because what it means is none of the employees of NASA can really be working on this, working on deflection, and working on being ready. That's a problem.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I had heard that observing time on some of those Chilean telescopes was less than a couple thousand dollars a night was what they bill for it. So I was wondering if that's the sort of thing that a small fundraising might be able to achieve for you.
Yeah, well, there are two things to say about that. Number one, while that may be the sort of amortized cost of an hour of observing time on one of those telescopes, I guarantee you that the list of people waiting to have observing time is huge. The scientific community in general, those telescopes are dedicated to science and astronomy. And, you know, this is really not astronomy. This is public safety. I mean, you've got early warning for a natural hazard. And the scientific community doesn't like to give up time on these big telescopes for something that's not science. And, it sounds like a bureaucratic thing, but that's really the case. Now, the second factor, which is very important, actually, is that those telescopes are, in general, not very good telescopes to use to look for near-Earth objects. What you need to find near-Earth objects, which is really what we need to do, what you need to find them is very wide-field telescopes, telescopes that see 20-degree fields of view or something like that and can cover the whole sky in a night or even a couple times in a night. That's the capability of the telescopes that you need. Those telescopes, the big telescopes, are great when you know where to look for something, and what you want to do is get all of your glass looking at a very, very, very small piece of sky, you know, generally measured in a few tens of arc seconds. So once you know where something is, then you can use a big telescope to zoom in on it and get a precise orbit on it, pretty precise orbit. But they're not good telescopes to find things.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you, Carl.
I'll drop the line and leave it for the next caller.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Listeners, so that does free up our toll-free line, and you're welcome to use it, 1-866-687-7223. Last week, we all paid attention to the press conference with Planetary Resources, and their desire to put a lot of swarms, I guess, of 9-inch type of NEO-looking telescopes in space, as well as having the capability to look back at Earth. Is an orbiting 9-inch telescope capable of doing what you're talking about?
No. No, not at all. An orbiting 9-inch telescope is capable, orbiting an asteroid, of getting one heck of a lot of information about that asteroid. And, you know, Planetary Resources is ultimately looking at using a swarm of very modest spacecraft to do a kind of cooperative job on an asteroid. I mean, you send up, who knows, 8 or 10 of these things to an asteroid that you want to look at and say, is it worth prospecting on it? You know, it's sort of a prospecting team is what you've got there.
Right.
And you may have, you know, one of those telescopes or a couple of them who are dedicated to communication with the Earth and relaying from the other, you know, 80% or something like that. And some of them are looking at spectrally at the surface, and maybe others are bombarding the surface with neutrons and using a neutron spectrometer. Who knows what? But that's the idea for those small telescopes. It's really not to find the population of near-Earth objects which they might go to. That you're going to have, you know, a big search operation. It's the same kind of thing that you would do for planetary defense. I mean, really, you know, asteroids, David, are very, very interesting things, and I'm delighted that Planetary Resources, you know, have come out and opened up the whole idea, which those of us in kind of in the business have been aware of for many years. That is that asteroids are not just a threat. I mean, I happen to be pretty much focused on the threat aspect. I mean, survival comes first, but the resource potential in near-Earth asteroids is huge and can make a tremendous long-term difference in terms of our ability, the cost of exploring and developing space resources and utilization of all kinds. So I think it's very exciting that they've you know, gotten people their major investors and the work that they're doing. They certainly have a long way to go, but step number one for all of us, whether it's planetary defense or whether it's sending human astronauts or something out to an asteroid as part of the Obama program, you know, set as a goal, or whether it is resource exploitation, in all cases, you first have to find and form a database, develop the inventory of all of these objects. And that's a big task, but that's sort of step one for all of these different interesting aspects of asteroids.
We'll take a break. We're a little beyond halfway through the show, but real quickly, so am I to understand correctly that there is no U.S. government agency entrusted with the role of protecting us from an incoming NEO? NASA doesn't have that job description, and no other government agency has it either?
Yeah, that's right, David. I mean, it's sort of implied, but the fact of the matter is, nobody has that assigned responsibility at the moment.
And I'm assuming no ESA organization or other national space agency around the world has anything like that either, right?
No, not to my knowledge. Now, you know, there may be some interpretation of something in Russia that says that the Russian Space Agency does, but I think you'd be hard-pressed to find you know, an explicit responsibility assigned to any space agency at the moment.
Listeners, as I said, we're a little beyond halfway through the show. We'll take our break right here, and we'll come back with Rusty and more on these issues in planetary defense in 3 minutes. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. This is our second segment on our Space Show. We're talking planetary defense with Rusty Schweikert. And again, you can call us 1-866-687-7223. So, Rusty, at what point is the decision made to evacuate rather than to try to deflect or blow it up or do something different? And what, I mean, we've all seen what happens in evacuations from hurricanes in Florida and things. It's not the best thing to be caught in. How does this work for something like planetary defense?
David, I'm going to disagree with you a little bit. While it may not be fun to be caught in an evacuation out of a major city, it's a heck of a lot better than being caught in an impact in a major city.
Well, correct, or the waves that are coming over from the hurricane. That's true.
Right. So you don't have one willy nilly. The most likely. I mean, we're going to have to talk about two different types of warning here. The most likely situation for an evacuation is where you're dealing with a relatively small object. Small objects are going to be the last ones that we know that we're going to be able to predict long times in advance that they're going to hit. Because there are so many of them out there, there's about a million objects about the size of the Tunguska object that wiped out 800 square miles of the Siberian forest. And it's going to be a long time before we have all of those in our database and can predict decades ahead of time when one might hit. The result of that is that most of the time, objects of that kind come in and hit us, and we don't even know about them until they hit. So that brings up, rather than the long-term warning kind of thing, which we're working, although we got a long way to go, but nevertheless, we've got 10 years or more, 12 years under our belt in looking at those things. The other warning is a last-minute warning, where what you're doing now is you're literally looking in the direction from which objects are coming if they're going to hit you. And if you, I'm not going to go into the technical reasons for it, but basically in the night sky, that's where the anti-solar point is, or the anti-solar direction. These things, when they impact Earth, not when they fly by it, but when they impact Earth, come generally out of the sun or out of the anti-sun, if you will. So in the night sky, you can use relatively modest telescopes. I mean, this is one that goes back to, you know, Carl's question from up in Maine. You know, once we get a network of these things set up, a few thousand dollars or, you know, a few $100,000, tens of thousands anyway, you could make a telescope that could be part of a network which is looking for last-minute warning on objects that would do some damage. And in that case, you know, we could have, for a Tunguska-like object, we could probably have 2 to 5 days of warning. And for an object the size of AG5, you know, something like a 100-meter object or a 140-meter object, we might get as much as a month or 2 months of warning. And in that kind of a case, you have no chance of deflection. I mean, you can't deflect something in that kind of a time frame. But what you can do is quite accurately determine where it's going to impact, and you can evacuate people from the impact zone. So that's where that is most likely to come. And we've only fairly recently realized that this last-minute warning capability is pretty realistic.
And then, of course, the property damage and everything that comes with it, that you just take the hit after you've evacuated people.
Yeah, there's nothing you can do about that. Long-term warning, I mean, early warning, you know, that's why deflection is certainly very valuable, but again, you know, deflection is going to cost you, you know, somewhere, let's say, minimally $500 million and up to $1 billion or perhaps even a bit more. So, you know, people are going to be weighing the cost of evacuation versus the cost of prevention, of deflection. And there's no way to get out of that. I mean, you know, you're dealing with the real world and taxpayers and all the rest. So,
and of course, if it's your property that's going to be destroyed and the choice is made to let it be destroyed, who compensates you for it?
You know, good question.
It's a political decision to
insurance companies. Good luck.
I don't know. Is in the homeowner's policy or building policy is. Is getting hit by an asteroid an exclusion?
Well, I have actually heard that some insurance companies do not have that as an exclusion. Now, I suspect that after a near miss, or say a small one hits somewhere in the ocean or something, I think they may be rethinking that one. But in any event, it might be something that if you're worried, you want to check on. But to be frank about it, David, you know, this is not something which we ought to have people worrying at that level about. Now, you did mention, by the way, you know, do we have any idea where any of these things might hit if we've got an early warning?
Right. So I'm thinking again, NASA was trying to predict where these incoming satellites were coming in. Remember last year there were a couple of them. And they couldn't predict until they were almost ready to hit into the Earth's atmosphere, and then at the last minute they had a pretty huge range of where they were coming in.
Right.
Are we better off with a NEO, or is it the same principle?
Well, it's not at all the same principle. I mean, the principle, the thing that gives you, you know, headaches when you're looking at space debris coming in or an old satellite or something like that is, you know, that the atmosphere, extremely thin atmosphere at very high altitudes, is working on the satellite and slowing it down, and you don't have good measurements up there of you know, what the drag is on a spacecraft, if its solar arrays have flipped around, or, you know, who knows what. So you have a lot of uncertainty about exactly when this thing is going to enter. And because you've got uncertainty about when it's going to enter, you know, that means the where goes with the when. If you don't know when it's going to reenter, you really can't say where. Conversely, if you know when it's going to reenter, that pinpoints it. But that's not the issue. Now, with asteroids, you know when it's going to hit, if it's going to hit. So what you can't tell exactly is where along a line across the Earth it's going to hit. If you think about the asteroid being that's going to hit the Earth, an asteroid that's going to hit the Earth, it's in a plane which intersects the surface of the Earth. And if you look at the intersection of a plane of that asteroid with the surface of the Earth, that makes a circle around the Earth in a sense, but it's only the front side of it. You know, it becomes, if you're riding on the asteroid headed toward the Earth, it's a line all the way across the Earth. And the uncertainty that we have in terms of asteroids is not so much when they hit, but where are they along that line. And in general, until the probability, and in fact, specifically, unless the probability is one, you know, you don't know that it's going to hit anywhere on that line. If the probability is 1 in 50, the line goes, you know, 49 Earth diameters off the Earth on either side, and the probability is only 1 in 50 that you're actually going to hit somewhere on that line. So generally speaking, when we have any asteroid with a probability of impact, what we can calculate is where that line is across the Earth, because that line is determined by the orientation of the plane of the asteroid. And though there's very little uncertainty in the parameters which define the plane, so that's pretty certain. And for example, with Apophis, if you take good old Apophis, which, you know, we found in 2004 and still has a very low probability of impacting the Earth, we know quite precisely where that line crosses the Earth. With AG5, I calculated approximately where that line would be, and it looks like it would cross somewhere in Central South America. Or let me put it this way. If you looked at that line all the way across the Earth, it's mainly ocean, but it does cross South America. I'm not quite sure whether it's above or below the equator, but yes, it is calculable, and we're not on that line.
This is a question from Linda in Seattle. She sent us an email. We frequently hear, whether it's real or not, that we could deflect an asteroid with a nuclear weapon. Is that true?
The answer is probably yes. And in fact, there are basically three methodologies that those of us who deal with this business generally consider to be available technologies. Two of them are what I would call robust but inaccurate or imprecise. Kinetic impact is one. Run into it. The other is a nuclear explosion very nearby the asteroid, which is referred to as a standoff nuclear explosion, which would instantaneously heat up the side of the asteroid toward the nuclear explosion to the point where it violently boils off, vaporizes, and pushes the asteroid in the opposite direction. It's not actually the blast effect of the nuclear weapon, and you don't try to destroy it or anything. What you do is you just vaporize the side of the asteroid, one side of the asteroid, and it pushes the asteroid in the other direction. So the answer is yes, those are both robust and imprecise. And then the gravity tractor is the opposite. The gravity tractor is a very wimpy deflection capability, but it's very precise. You can make a very small change in the orbit of the asteroid, but you can do exactly what you want. So, in fact, we generally think of a deflection campaign where the heavy lifting is done by the robust technique, and the precision endpoint that you want, you get with a subsequent gravity tractor trimming action. So nuclear technology is one that we have talked about, but, you know, we've never designed a nuclear weapon to blow up in space near an asteroid. So there's work to be done there, and nobody wants to have nukes in space. I mean, that's something that the rest of the world in particular, but many, many people in the United States as well, are very suspicious of, that you end up putting nuclear weapons in space. And, you know, people don't trust the United States for anything around the world, but putting nukes in space to save their butts is, you know, that's not something people are going to easily take to. So we consider the use of nuclear explosion only as a last resort when a kinetic impact is inadequate to do the job, or it's too late to use a kinetic impactor, and then you might use a nuclear explosion.
How big would the nuclear explosion have to be? Are we talking huge bombs or just small ones like Hiroshima? I mean, what do you need for something like that?
Well, you would need something that exceeds the capability of a kinetic impactor. And in general, what that means is that the size of the object, if you've got plenty of warning time, the size of the object would probably have to be something on the order of 300 to 400 meters in diameter or larger. And the frequency with which the Earth gets hit by something like that is only one in several hundred thousand years, once every several hundred thousand years. So the likelihood that we would have to, that we would have an impact which would require a nuclear weapon to be used, again, if we had lots of warning time, the likelihood of running into something that size would be extremely small. The more likely, I hate to say it, David, but the more likely reason that we would want to use a nuclear weapon is because a kinetic impact, just sending up something to run into it, is perfectly adequate. But on the other hand, if we get too close to the impact, if we just keep arguing about what to do and should we do anything and who's going to pay for it and blah, 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 then you get to a point where the kinetic impactor can no longer do the job and you need something bigger. And so the most likely, in my view, the most likely time cause for using a nuclear weapon to deflect an asteroid is bureaucratic procrastination. And that may well happen.
You have another caller on hold. Hi, caller. Are you still with us, please?
Yes.
And you're John, right?
Yep, I am.
Go for it, please.
Oh, yeah. By the way, I was around and remember Apollo 9, so wanted to mention that.
Yeah, you're an old-timer. We know that.
Yeah. I was wondering, I guess you kind of, there's this timeline you're calling, but how much of a momentum change do you have to have, and maybe we should ask the question of when you have to have it to do this deflection? You're talking about the kinetic impactor versus like a nuclear explosion, but I mean, how big of a momentum change are we talking about here?
Well, you know, momentum change is not a term which most people are familiar with. I can talk about it in terms of momentum, but probably an equivalent term that makes more sense to people is the velocity change which you need to give the asteroid. And I'll give you a somewhat typical example with, let's say, 10 years or 15 years of warning. What you're talking about is changing the velocity of the asteroid by something like a centimeter per second, plus or minus a bit, 50% or so. But a centimeter per second is sort of the velocity change that you're talking about, which would allow you to miss the Earth with something, maybe 2 centimeters per second. But that's the sort of change in velocity that you're talking about. Now, in many cases, if you're talking about a keyhole, missing a keyhole, which is, again, much smaller. Now you're talking about, you know, a millimeter per second or something of that kind. So let me try to convert that. I'm sorry, I speak in metric terms, but you're probably talking a couple of hundredths of a mile an hour. Not a couple hundred, but a couple hundredths of a mile an hour velocity change. Now, that's a very, very small change in the speed of the asteroid, but when you multiply it times the mass of the asteroid, you're talking about, you know, a billion kilograms or something like that for an asteroid. So it's a couple of billion, 10 billion pounds, something like that. So that's a huge, huge object that you're trying to get a very small change in velocity on.
Okay. But if we're talking, okay, so but we would have the ability to even like 10 years out or something to know that this thing was going to actually become a problem then.
You 10 years in advance, if it's, a, you know, there, again, there, you need to sort of separate the two different things in your mind. One, is it headed for a keyhole, which would set up a subsequent impact, or has it already done that and is headed for a direct impact? If it's headed for a direct impact, now you're talking about you have to make it miss something the size of the Earth, in fact, bigger than the Earth. That's a big task. 10 years ahead of time, you would know that. And if you're talking about a keyhole, the good news is it doesn't take anywhere near as much of a deflection to get it to miss a keyhole. The bad news is it's a heck of a lot harder to tell if it's actually headed for the keyhole. So that's the trade-off between the two. Now, 10 years ahead of something going through a keyhole, you probably don't know for certain that it is going to go through the keyhole. This is a little bit like standing at home plate and having a fastball pitcher throw some real heat at you, okay? And to make it interesting, think of your head being over the center of home plate. And, you know, one strike and you're gone. Now, if you think about a fastball coming at you and you're going to protect the plate, the question that you have to ask is, when do you have to start your swing? Okay? And I'll tell you something. If you wait until you know it's a strike, you're dead. Because you can't swing fast enough to protect the plate. Then you have to make a judgment when it's still uncertain whether or not that pitch is going to come over home plate. Now, you can try to check your swing if later information sort of tells you, well, it's not going to make the plate, it's going to be a ball. But you have to make the decision and you have to actually start tensing your muscles and getting your, you know, that reaction time going if you're going to protect it. That's exactly the same thing with, you know, keeping an asteroid out of a keyhole. In general, you're going to have to make a decision before you know that it's going to pass through the keyhole to keep it out of the keyhole. And the only time you finally know whether or not it's headed for the keyhole is when you get that observer spacecraft up there and rendezvous with the asteroid. Now you have a several orders of magnitude better tracking capability because your spacecraft has a transponder on it and you can know precisely now if you're flying formation with the asteroid whether or not it's headed for the keyhole. But if you're counting on telescopes from the ground to make those measurements, the uncertainty is too great.
So
that's the dilemma. It's not a simple. It would be nice if it were simpler, but it's not. You know, we can't make exact measurements, and so generally speaking, we have to make a decision whether or not to deflect before we know if it's headed for a keyhole. That we're going to have to make a decision whether or not to deflect before we know for certain that it's going to go through a keyhole. Now, that's not so bad because, you know, that might happen once every 10 or 15 years. And once every 10 or 15 years, we can easily afford a scientific mission to an asteroid, which is what you turn that mission into if it's not headed for the keel.
Yeah, I see. So in other words, basically, you assess these things. Anything that has a probability above a certain threshold, you would go ahead and deflect it.
Right. Now, you want to tell me what that threshold is?
Let me be something that somebody would have to make as a policy.
Well, that's part of that. That's another one of the issues that we've thrown at the United Nations. You know, whoever's going to pay for it has got to make that kind of a decision, and you know, that ought to be a collective decision of the world.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like you'd have to have some group of experts and that would be appointed to do this. They'd have to make a decision that.
Yep.
That's exactly what we've been doing
in the UN for the last 6 years. So, and we're making progress, but you know, everything is very slow.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
Not something to worry about, but it is something to, you know, you don't worry about having an accident tomorrow, but you buy insurance.
Maybe the thing is, it's one of these things that you actually have to have an impact that does some damage one time before you have a real policy on it.
Okay, John, I'll tell everybody you said that.
Well, wasn't that the concept in Arthur C. Clarke's book, Rendezvous with Rama, how they got their capability put in place?
Yeah, there you go. That's exactly right.
They had a bad incident. And
the only difference is that's science fiction
policy.
And this is reality.
Hey, Rusty, I want to breathe some life into your baseball analogy because I'm a baseball guy. So the San Diego Padres have this pitcher that consistently throws 103, 104 mile per hour fastballs late in the game. He's a pretty amazing guy. So the home plate is 60 and a half feet to from the pitcher's mound.
Right.
So for the ball to get there, it's 0.39 of a second.
Uh-huh.
And the batter has to be able to coordinate his eyes and hands and arms and everything to swing in less than a third of a second, or he's missed the ball.
Well, actually, but go a little bit further, David, because I would guess, you know, the reaction time is probably 0.2 of a second or something like that. And so, what that means is that the batter has got to decide to start swinging when the ball is less than a third of the way to the plate.
Right, and most of us can't even see that ball.
Right.
The radar gun sees it, and you get to see the speed after the pitch is caught.
Yeah.
And try catching a 104 mile an hour ball, no matter how thick your catcher's mitt is. But I mean, I have tried to see the ball, and I can't see it moving.
Yeah.
So.
Well, especially when it's coming right at you. I mean, when it's coming, you know, when it's coming directly or nearly directly at you, you really have very little to judge by. You know, it's a very interesting analogy with the deflection issue because there are many, many things about it which are valid. You know, all analogs can be stretched too far, but there are a lot of very interesting things. You really do have to generally make the decision when you're less than certain that it's going to hit if you want to ensure that you don't get hit. And that's... that means money, but as I say, you know, we do spend money for scientific research and on things like asteroids, and they are, you know, ore bodies, as we know, or resource bodies. So there are lots of good reasons to study asteroids, and this is sort of a fallback position for the 9 out of 10 cases. If the probability is 1 in 10 when you have to make this decision, you know, then 9 out of 10, you've got yourself a scientific mission, which is also very useful.
The interesting thing is these batters make the right decision. I have no clue how, and they get hits and home runs, and it's a miracle.
And they also get hit once in a while, David.
They get, yeah, sometimes intentionally, you know. But
yeah, right.
John, do you have anything else for Rusty tonight?
I guess that's about it. Let's put a line on somebody else.
Okay, thanks a lot, John. Listeners, there's still time if you want to give us a quick call, 1-866-687-7223. Rusty, if you don't mind, I sometimes read news bulletins that come through on the show. So the scrub on the Falcon 9 is in place now on May 7th, and it may be May 10th, but possibly later than that for the Falcon 9 flight. And Elon has said that they need a lot more time to discuss the results of their static firing yesterday and the overall status of launch processing with senior NASA managers, da-da-da-da-da-da. And this is a Bill Harwood CBS email that just came in a second ago. So no launch on Monday the 7th, maybe the 10th, and then they stand down because there's a high-security Air Force payload that's about to go.
Yeah.
And there's also the Russian Soyuz is taking crew change up to the station. Mm. And with traffic management, it's one vehicle at a time. So we wait and see, but it looks like Monday is...
Monday's off.
Monday's off, yeah. Hmm. Well, you were probably used to launch delays, right?
Oh, yeah. We were launching in February, and then... at the last minute, the doctors decided our throats looked a little too red, and they were afraid we might be catching a cold, and so we ended up slipping into March. So,
did you catch a cold?
No, we didn't have one, but, you know, the doctors were being extra cautious.
So if we're launching to deflect an incoming and something happens and you miss your window, this is pretty serious, right?
It is indeed, unless you have purposely given yourself a substantial window. Generally speaking, I think the windows for launch for something like this are not the super narrow, you know, a few minutes.
For the station?
Yeah, for space station, because you're not rendezvousing in that way. You know, this is more like a window that you would have in launching something to... you know, to Mars or something of that kind. So you have a little bit more flexibility, but if you have a serious delay, now you can be in real trouble unless you have picked the launch window prior to the last one that's, you know, available. So
we really didn't talk about that during the show, but the orbital dynamics of getting there and the windows and where you're going to launch from, the site you're going to launch from, and all of that is going to play a role in this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the thing which, I mean, once an asteroid gets to the point where its threat level, that is, its impact probability and the time to impact is relatively short and, you know, that sort of thing. When you look at the threat and it gets above a certain fuzzy, ill-defined threat level, then the major issue becomes the timeline. It's again, going from the ball coming across the plate back out toward the pitcher, and the question is, where going backward from the impact do you have to start your design, manufacturing, assembly, testing, launch, rendezvous, deflection? You know, that whole sequence of things backs up for 5 years or more, depending upon the circumstance. And when you start adding all those things together, and it's unique for each asteroid threat, you may find that you have to launch at an uncomfortable low probability of impact. That's the problem. The world is going to be faced with decisions fairly often, maybe once every 10 or 15 years, of do we or do we not spend money to ensure that this one does not go through a keyhole and hit us?
Fascinating. You know, absolutely fascinating. So when it comes down to it, the 9 years you mentioned when we started the show may not be very much time at all.
Well, that's exactly the question, and the only way you can answer that is to assume that it's going to go through the keyhole in 2023, and then back up what has to happen. And when you back all of that up, you come close to now. How close? excuse me. How close is a matter of you know, serious analysis and engineering judgment about, let's say, the readiness, for example, of your terminal guidance software and your terminal guidance capability. I mentioned that that's going to be a challenge on this one because, unlike Comet Temple 1, this has about 2,000 times less cross-sectional area. And, of course, when you're talking about terminal guidance, you got to see it. And if it's 2,000 times less sizable, you know, that increases the challenge of your terminal guidance concepts. So that's the kind of question. Is that terminal guidance really ready? Will it be ready? Can we wait until 2013 when we see this thing again the next time before we start saying, is the terminal guidance capable? Or at that time, do we have to go right into assembly manufacturing and get the thing off the pad? So that's, you know, we have to do some work, you know.
You have another call if you can stay an extra few minutes to to take it. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Hi, this is Terry in Corpus Christi.
Go for it, Terry.
Rusty, what is the least expensive monitoring satellite that they could launch to monitor one of these asteroids?
Something
that would give us, you know, it's...
Terry, we're going to have to decide, are we trying to find them? Or are you talking about monitoring some particular one that we already know about?
Probably something that we know about is just like this one that we're worried about hitting the keyhole. If we could monitor it on a 24-hour basis, you know, we bound to be able to get better projections as far as orbit and all of that.
Well, the only way, I mean, no telescope on the ground can continuously monitor an asteroid because asteroids are in independent orbits and sometimes they're on the same side of the sun as us and other times they're behind the sun. They can get very close to us when it's easy to see them. They can get further away where you can't see them at all. So any kind of a telescope on the ground is not going to do the job. If you want continuous monitoring, which generally speaking you don't really need, but if you want continuous monitoring, the only way to do it is to have a spacecraft basically flying around with the asteroid. In other words, you want to rendezvous with it and station keep with it and monitor it that way. But that's expensive. I mean, now you're talking, you know, a $300 million mission, or maybe if you want to go on the cheap, you know, you might use a microsatellite and still get it out there for maybe a couple $100 million, but you know, that's the kind of cost you're talking about. And of course, unless you know something is going to hit you or come very close, has a high probability of hitting you, that's a pretty big bill to pay just to watch a satellite, just to watch one of millions of asteroids. So generally speaking, you're going to track them with telescopes. And a space telescope is a notch up in terms of benefit from a ground-based telescope. But a space telescope, no matter where you put it, is going to episodically lose the ability to track any given asteroid. You know, so it's a question of seeing them from time to time, but enough in advance of an impact that you can get good orbit on them, good tracking.
What are the projections after 2040 as far as us getting hit? Or 1 in 500 at 2040?
Oh, no, 1 in 500 is this one particular asteroid. But there are millions of them out there, most of which we don't even know about. So, you know, we could get hit tomorrow.
But the one that's supposedly going to get close to the keyhole, do they have any projections after 2040? How close?
The answer is yes, but not very good, because you have to appreciate that that asteroid, if it misses us in 2040, I mean, if we do nothing about it, okay, let's just say that it's not going to hit us, okay, it will come close to us. And whenever an asteroid comes close to the Earth, as I had said earlier in the program, the gravitational effect of the Earth is going to dramatically change its orbit. So anytime you're looking far in advance on these asteroids, if they come near any planet, the Earth, even the Moon or Mars, Jupiter, whatever, their orbits are changing, I would say all the time, but you have to appreciate all the time means maybe once every 10,000 years or something. I mean, you know. So these asteroids, we have to keep tracking them, because even though it's, you know, in many cases thousands of years between the time they come close to a planet, they do, and we have to keep track of them to make sure that we know what its current orbit is.
Well, that's all from me. I appreciate you staying on the line, and okay. Thanks for coming on the program. Good night.
Thanks.
You're
a
welcome.
Lot. As we wind down our program, you mentioned earlier that what we could do would be to, lobby or pressure our members of Congress. Is that the best advice you can give those of us that are really interested in this subject and this issue? You know, if we take 100% of space shuttle programs I do a year, probably 95% of them deal with policy, propulsion, rockets, human spaceflight, let's go to Mars, let's go to the Moon, not the subject we're talking about tonight. And then a couple of them deal with space debris issues, but they focus on debris and not being hit by an incoming.
Yeah.
And so this is kind of like the poor boy of space advocacy and space enthusiasm.
Yeah, isn't that an irony, since this is survival?
Well, that's what I'm getting at. It's like, you know, where are our priorities here, right?
Yeah.
What difference does it make if we have great big rockets or SpaceX or this or that if Los Angeles gets wiped off the map?
Right. Well, David, to answer your question, again, and going back to Carl's question earlier, if you've got no money or modest amounts of money, then, you know, the primary thing, which I think you can contribute to, is to ensure that there is an assignment of responsibility so that there is some government agency, and in my view, it ought to be NASA, who is responsible for protecting the Earth from asteroid impacts. That is a sine qua non. Somebody has got to be responsible, and right now, frankly, nobody is. If you got a bit more money and you're, inclined as an astronomer, you could certainly help get this program of last-minute warning telescopes going, and I refer you, you can Google it, I can't give you the site, but if you Google ATLAS, A-T-L-A-S, there is a program, a design that has been put together by some astronomers at the University of Hawaii, which could, in fact, form a worldwide network of last-minute warning. And there you're talking, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that's not unreasonable for a large astronomical club or something. On the other hand, if you happen to be a Silicon Valley, or other billionaire or multimillionaire, then the next most important thing to do would be to contribute to the effort that B612 was involved in of getting a space telescope out there to find the 99% of things we don't even know are, have a chance of hitting us. So those are the three things I would do depending upon where your pocketbook sits.
Listeners, that's I guess our challenge is to maybe improve the focus of what we talk about on the space show to make all of this a priority as well. Does NASA want the job of the responsibility of protecting us? If Congress said we're going to amend the mission of NASA and this is what you're going to do, would they want it?
Well, David, let me put that in perspective. When you talk about amending the mission of NASA, what we're talking about here, by the way, Tom Jones and I ran a Planetary Defense Task Force for NASA, for the NASA Advisory Council, actually. And among other things, we made an estimate of what would be required. And for the next 10 years, it would require about $250 million a year to do the job, and after that it would fall back. So you're talking between 1 and 2% of NASA's budget for 10 years, and then it falls back to less than 1% of NASA's budget. So don't think of this as an alternative to NASA's current responsibility for exploration or science. This hardly makes a dent in it. I mean, that's the irony of this thing. It costs you $1.98 to do the job.
No, I just don't want Congress to say, here's an additional thing to do, and you got to fund it out of your existing programs.
And that is exactly why NASA, up until this point, and even today, has been relatively negative about doing anything about the NEO threat, because, generally speaking, the Congress gives you something to do and doesn't give you the money to follow it up.
Right.
And that's why NASA needs to have this responsibility, so that they can request the funding. NASA can't request funding to do something it's not responsible for. So that's part of the problem. This is a chicken and egg problem, and until NASA is given the responsibility, they can't really ask for the budget.
And Congress has to give them the responsibility.
Congress and the White House, yeah, it's a cooperative thing. And the White House is sort of there, but NASA is, let me just say, as an institution, forget individual people who have many, many different viewpoints, but as an institution, NASA is not enthusiastic about this. Partly because it's a misunderstanding. NASA in the past has seemed to think that if they have this responsibility, at some point they're going to need to have a standing army. That's not the case, because if you do this job right, you've got 20, 30, 40 years of warning, which is plenty of time to build something and launch it. You don't have to have, this is not an alert force for the Russian bear bombers coming over the horizon. I mean, this is something where you've got plenty of early warning to do the job. You don't have to have a standing force on the pad ready to go or anything like that.
Interesting. And when I hear people I greatly respect, like Neil deGrasse Tyson, speak for a larger NASA budget for 1%,
right,
instead of the half of 1%, this doesn't even get mentioned.
Right. But, you know, if you think about the points that Neil does make about stimulation of the economy and inspiring young people and all of the rest of it that Neil's doing a super job on, and then you combine that with what I've been talking about, which is fundamentally a survival issue, and both of them are related to space technology and exciting stuff for young people, I mean, it's a natural combination. It's something that we ought to be spending money on. And ironically, we're not. We're sitting here, you know, flying around a solar system uninsured.
I can't see a downside, except obviously the politicians see a downside. But
well, we just have to elect you, David.
Yeah, right. I don't think that I'm going to make it very far in the election process. You have to be somewhat of a diplomat, you know, and a little bit politically correct and not totally outspoken. And
yeah, well, maybe that's part of the problem too. Who knows?
And any closing comments, pearls of wisdom, any other suggestions or ideas you'd like to leave us with tonight?
Well, I think it's a fascinating thing. I would love to see parents, you know, pointing their kids in this direction. I mean, this is fascinating stuff. It's not just science. Science is fun too, but, you know, with the stuff that Planetary Resources has talked about and opening up, near-Earth asteroids for resource development, and with the stuff we've been talking about on defending, you know, life on the Earth from the occasional impact, I mean, it's fascinating stuff for kids to get into.
Absolutely. Rusty, until the next time we talk about it, and hopefully there'll be some changes, I appreciate your coming back on the show and going through all of this with us.
Well, you're very welcome. And, you know, we and NASA are still working out what to do with AG5, but, you know, we're getting there.
Okay. I appreciate it. I look forward to talking to you again down the road. And certainly thank you for all of your great work and all of your great space work over the years. I don't think our program would be the same if people such as yourself had not given all to it. So you have all of our thanks and appreciation.
Okay, David. Thanks a lot. Night. Okay,
thank you. And listeners, that's it. Good night from the Space Show. And back again with our typical Friday morning program. Goodbye, all.